All right, now that we looked at Windows security, let's go ahead and look at Linux, Unix security, and how that works and fits in the enterprise. Now, what's interesting is when we look at Linux and Unix, we're dealing with a completely different problem set because there's a lot less Linux systems out there than there are typically Windows systems. If you look at just the general market share, right now today about 85% of all systems are Windows, and then the other 15% are all other varieties of Linux, Unix, Mac OS, and others that are out there. Now, the first fallacy that we need to clear up is many people think that Windows is targeted. There's more worms and more exploits for Windows because Windows is not as secure as Linux. That's actually not true. The reason why Windows is targeted more than Unix and Linux is because Windows has a larger install base. If we actually went in and looked at the vulnerability data, I can send you the chart. Linux has the same number of vulnerabilities every single year as Windows does. Building operating systems are complex, and Unix, Linux, and Windows all have around the same number of vulnerabilities. The reason why Windows is targeted more is because of the install base. It's not because it's less secure, which means your Linux boxes in your control networks have the same exposures and vulnerabilities that Windows does. Now, there's two interesting pieces to that. First, if I showed you this chart from 10 years ago, you know what this number used to be? 96%. The number of Windows systems is decreasing, which means the number of Linux systems are increasing. Now, if Windows systems are targeted more because of the install base and Linux is increasing in popularity, we're going to see an increased number of attacks go after the Linux boxes. Second important data point. Most people know Windows systems are targeted, so they tend to put a lot of security on their Windows boxes. Many of our clients do a lot of hardening, lockdown, application whitelisting on their Windows boxes. What do they do on Linux? Not a whole lot, because they don't think it's going to be targeted as much. Now, if you're an adversary and you have some Linux boxes and some Windows boxes, and you know the Windows systems are locked down and really secure, and the Linux boxes are not, which ones are you going to target? Linux systems. Now, third piece to remember. This number is for normal organizations, both regular, financial, healthcare, and control system environments. In control system environments, there's a lot more Linux because of it's free, and you can do minimalistic kernels. So a lot of the different devices that are out there tend to be Linux kernels that are running in your environment. So based on all of that, Linux security becomes a pretty high priority area in control systems because they're often not as protected. There tends to be more of them, and they're often residing on field devices, which are easy targets because they have physical access and visibility to the outside world. So for that reason, protecting, securing, and locking down our Linux systems becomes a very important thing to do. Now, I started off our discussion with Windows by going in and showing you the Windows landscape. The client server. Now, it had a lot of parts, but it was pretty straightforward and linear because if you want Windows, there's only one company that sells it, Microsoft. There's no other organization that sells it. There's a single source that you go to for Windows operating systems. However, with Linux, because it's an open standard, you have so many choices to choose from. You have so many different varieties out there, from your Linux to your Mac OS X to your free BSD to your open BSD to your AIX to your open server, HPUX, and the list goes on and on and on and on. So the good news is all of the different varieties of Unix all work in a similar manner. The problem is the configuration details are slightly different. So what we're going to focus in on the rest of today is understanding how Unix works and how you find out the implementation details. So this way, when you go into a control system environment, you can be able to quickly find, assess, and understand how that specific Unix Linux system is configured, working, and set up, because there's so many varieties and each one is configured, installed, and set up separately. Now, if we look at a computer at the most basic level, it is really broken down into three main components: the hardware, the kernel, and the shell. The hardware is the physical components, the CPU, the memory, the NIC. Hardware by itself is essentially useless. Hardware can't do anything on its own. Hardware needs to be told what to do, which is the kernel. The kernel is the brains of the system. The kernel controls and manages how the system operates, and then the shell is the rest of the operating system that interfaces and allows the user to work with the system. The easiest way I describe it is a computer is like the human body. My bones are the hardware, my brain is the kernel, and my muscle and skin is the shell. So that sort of gives you an idea of how the pieces work together. The hardware, oh no, please don't ask him about temperature. Ask Graham about temperature, right? Graham, I need you to intervene, man. Get a little cooler in here. It's getting hot. So we go in, and the hardware is the physical components of the system. Then the kernel is the brains of how it functions. And then the shell is the interaction that the users utilize in order to manage and run the system. Going in and protecting, controlling, and managing the kernel is critical to your system. That is the brains. If somebody can go in and manipulate, change, or alter the brains of the computer, bad things can happen. Therefore, whenever you're updating, changing, or altering your Linux systems and control systems, be careful of any kernel-level changes. Kernel-level patches are very dangerous. Now, they're a necessity because if there's a kernel-level vulnerability, that's very, very dangerous. But once again, which is better? Having a running system that's performing a function in your environment that has a vulnerability, that's option A, or option B is we patch the kernel, we crash the box, and the box isn't running. So option B is you have a secure crash system that's not running, or A, you have a non-secure system that is running. In control system environments, A is the right answer every single day of the week. So that's the problem that we have to remember, is a secure non-functional system is worse than a functional non-secure system. So anything that's touching, dealing with, or going after that kernel, we want to make sure we're real careful with in protecting, controlling, and managing. Now, I'm going to backpedal a little. When I started this module, I made the statement that if you look at Windows, if you look at the varieties of Linux, and you look at the varieties of Unix, and you plot out the vulnerabilities, they all have around the same number of vulnerabilities. So from an attack vector perspective, all operating systems have about the same exposures, vulnerabilities, and attack vectors available to them. However, there's a big difference in installation between Windows and Linux. With Windows, how do you install a Windows system? You take one hard drive, you make one partition, you create one directory, and throw all the files in there. There's not a lot of structure. There's not a lot of organization. There's not a lot of control. So when you get to a Windows box, there's full access and full control to all pieces. With Linux, what do we typically do? We take one hard drive. We break it into different partitions. We take our operating system, break it into different logical subdirectories, and we put different logical directories on different partitions, and then we mount the partitions with different security controls. Now, by taking our operating system, slicing it down into pieces, taking our hard drive, breaking it into individual pieces, and putting different security controls on each of the pieces, just at installation, we can end up with a much more secure box from a Linux side because we have a lot more flexibility because security is engaging in installation time. With Windows, security doesn't engage till after installation. With Linux, security engages at time of installation. So we're going to always go in and we're going to try to take our operating system and break it down into logical pieces. An example of how this can be done is you can have a dev where your devices are. You can have a USR, which is your primary operating system directory. You can have your var where your log files are located. You can have your bin where you have your executables, your sbin where you have your privileged executables, and your home where all your user files reside. So typically, when you go into a Linux box, one of the first things you're going to do is type in ls. And ls is the listing of files so you can understand the logical file structure. Once you understand the logical file structure, what must you do next? You must understand the physical file system and how the logical file system maps to the physical file system. The way you do that is by going in and issuing the df command. The df command is going to show you each physical partition with the corresponding logical partitions that are mapped to each one of them. So here you can see that we have our root, our boot, our home. We could also have a USR, a var. I tried to keep it short, but you can have multiple partitions for each of the logical file systems on our system. Then when we go in and we mount each partition to make it available for use, we can put different security controls in place. Now let's step back and look at what we're trying to do here. We're trying to make life difficult for the adversary. We're trying to make it hard for somebody to break into your box. If an attacker is going to target and go after your system, what does an adversary want to do? They want to get access to your box. They want to upload code. They want to run a process. They want to create a command control channel, and they want to survive a reboot. In order for an adversary to accomplish all those tasks that I just mentioned, what are they going to need to do? They're going to need to do two things. Write information and run executables as a privileged user. That privileged user in Unix Linux is called root. So in essence, for an adversary to do harmful action, they need to be able to write files and run files as root on a given partition. Now, what's the problem? Normal users also need that activity, so we can't go in and remove it. Because ideally, what's the best way to make it hard for the adversary? Don't allow them to write anything, and don't allow anything to run as root. Well, the problem is if we configure our entire system like that, our users can't work or function correctly. But, there's a solution here. Adversaries need both. Normal users only need one. So a normal user would need to write files, but not run as root, or they would need to run as root, but not write files. So the good news is an adversary needs both write and root to do harm, and a legitimate user only needs one or the other. So our goal is, can we go in and design our system in such a way that when we go in and mount our partitions, that we can mount each partition as either read-only or no SUID. Read-only says you can read, but you can't write anything to that partition. You can't modify, change or alter anything on that particular partition. No SUID. SUID and SGID bits allow programs to run as root, even though the person running it doesn't have root access. So no SUID is saying the programs cannot run as root access. So no SUID is not allowing anything to run as root on that system. Now, you also have other ones like device files don't work. We're not worried. We're worried about the first two. Here's going to be our strategy. Our strategy is, can we design a system in a way that all file systems are mounted as either read-only or no SUID? So in essence, if I mount it read-only, you can run as root, but you can't write anything. If I mount it as no SUID, you can write, but you can't run as root. So now if our goal is to mount every partition as either read-only or no SUID, now we're letting the user have one or the other, but we're never letting the attacker have both. So for example, your USR, which is where your operating system resides, that absolutely needs to run as root, but you shouldn't be writing anything to the OS during normal running. So our USR can be mounted read-only. Your home directory actually definitely needs to be written to, but nothing should be running as root. So we're going to mount our home directory as no SUID in our system. Now just step back for a second. Before we even talk about patching, removing services, reducing the attack surface, if I design my Linux system at installation time where every single partition is either read-only or no SUID, how much harder and more difficult is it for the adversary to break in? Heck of a lot more harder than Windows, because how exactly are they going to break in? Let's go through a scenario. How are you actually going to break in and compromise my system? So I'm going to go after a user-level executable, and I'm going to write malicious code to the home directory. Great. So I can execute code, but I can't ever run as root. If I can't run as root, I can't change any OS processes. I can't ever run system-level calls, and I can't ever survive a reboot. So I'm not really going to be able to make long-term attack. Well, wait. What if I go after the USR and I take over a process and I'm able to exploit a root process on the USR directory and I get root access? What's the issue? It's on USR, so I can't write anything. So I can't upload code. I can't write malicious code. I can't do any backdoor processes. So just by going in and designing our system where every partition is no SUID or read only, we've just made it so much harder for the adversary to break in and cause damage. That's one of the reasons why in control systems, we really like to deploy Linux boxes, because by designing them in this way, I've gone in and de-emphasized the importance of patching and hardening. Now, you should still patch and harden as much as possible, but I would argue that if you have a Windows box that's installed one hard drive, one partition, one directory, all the files, and it's missing patches, and you have a Linux box that's designed the way I just described missing patches, I would say the Windows box is a heck of a lot easier to break into. The Linux box is going to be much, much harder. So that's one of the reasons in control systems, because we can add in mitigating controls at design and installation time, we can once again minimize the impact of not being able to do other security controls that we would normally like to do within our environment. Because most students in class are typically stronger in one operating system over another, we like giving you a little reference chart to be able to show you the commands between Windows and Unix. Now, some of the commands are identical, like changing directory. Some of the commands are similar, like copy and CP, and some of the files are completely different, like attrib and change mod for changing the file attributes on that system or that environment. Some of the other commands you should be familiar with on Linux is PS to view running processes. If you ever get stuck on a command, there's a manual page so you can run a man on the command to see what's happening, what's going on. So now that we've sort of introduced some of the commands and showed you how we design, hopefully you're getting an appreciation that the earlier you can engage security, the better. If I can engage security before we even install the operating system, as I just showed you, we could produce a much better product than if we're waiting till after it's installed and we have to try to add it on after the fact. Now, in a traditional IT environment, that's less of an issue. Why? Because in a traditional IT environment, I can go into a production system, I can patch it, I can harden it, I could lock down, I could do a lot of those stuff. So if you're going to let me do ongoing maintenance of that computer while it's in production, then designing it correctly at installation time is not as important. I can do other factors to make it a hard target to break into. But if we're talking about a situation where once something goes into production, you might not be able to change it, you might not be able to patch it, you might not be able to alter or remove anything for a very long period of time, now design structure becomes so much more critical. So this solution I laid out for you, you absolutely can do it in a regular IT environment. You absolutely can do it in a regular organization, but the value and benefit are not as great as they are in ICS because of the constraints that we're running under. So in Windows, we were talking about having to do all these other isolation, putting an application whitelisting. I would once again argue that our solution of mounting each partition read-only or no SUID is almost as good, if not better, than doing application whitelisting. So we don't have application whitelisting in Linux, but we do have installation design hardening that we can put in place to get it to an equal or better level of protection. Then if we want to lock down or secure our systems during acceptance testing, we need to be able to limit the visibility. Remember hacking. Hacking is three main steps: visible IPs, open ports, and vulnerabilities in the services. Therefore, in order to go in and make it harder for the adversary, before we ever go into production, we want to limit the ports, lock down the services, and limit the visibility into those devices. So we need to understand how these services run at boot up. There are essentially four ways we start services when we utilize a Unix system. The first one is when we boot up the system. So when we go in and we turn on the computer system, we're going to have certain services start up when we turn on the computer system. Thank you, my friend. The next one is we start up our computer, the kernel loads, the kernel starts up init, and init starts services at boot up. We don't want to have every service running 24/7. We only want to run services when they're needed in order to go in and maximize the efficiency of memory. So we're going to have programs like INetD and XINetD that are going to be able to start and stop services to be able to maximize the use of memory within our system. We can also have a scheduling service. So we could schedule tasks like auditing functions to run every evening or every morning. And the way we schedule that is with cron, which has a cron tab, which is the listing of jobs that run at set point and set time. And then, of course, if you've been doing in the lab, we can go in and run tools at command line where you're actually activating and starting and stopping them right on the system. So once again, let's take a little further look of how this works. When your system starts up and electricity starts going through the computer, BIOS, the basic input-output system, starts up first. Then BIOS is going to go to the boot device, start up the bootloader. The bootloader is going to go to the MBR, the master boot record, which is a special portion on the hard drive, and going to find the kernel. The kernel gets started, and the kernel is what integrates with the hardware to make it usable and available for use on the system. Then after the kernel starts, the kernel is going to start the init process or initialization, and it's going to go in and start all the other services that are needed in order for the system to be fully up and running. And the way init works is it has 5 run conditions that it uses when it starts up. Think of run conditions as directories, and each directory has a series of scripts. So init is going to go to the RC1 directory, start up the scripts. RC2 directory, start up the scripts. RC3, 4, and 5, and start up the scripts to get the systems up, running, and functioning properly. Now, in the early versions of Unix, what did we do? We had everything start at boot up by init. And what did we find? Our system would be up and running, and we'd be having hundreds of processes running, and they would be using 70% of memory. The problem? Many of these services are just running idle. They're not doing anything. They're not being used. Nobody's calling them. There's no request. So the question was, why do we have all of these services running 24/7 using up valuable memory when we could just start and stop them as needed? So what we did on Unix is we now go in and instead of starting all these services that are taking up 70% of memory, we now just start up inetd, which is a super daemon or metademon, and now inetd is only taking up 2% of memory, and then inetd will monitor all requests, and it will start and stop all the services as the requests come in. So now, for example, instead of running FTP 24 hours a day using up valuable memory, FTP is off and inetd monitors, and when a connection comes in on TCP port 21, inetd will start up FTP, it will service the request, and then when it's done, it will shut back down again, and then inetd will continue to monitor it. So the idea of inetd allows us to better utilize valuable memory and only run processes when they're absolutely needed to free up memory for other resources and other systems. Now, inetd was purely for functionality. It had zero security. It literally would monitor, and as requests came in, it would start up the respective services to access the request. Somebody had an idea, a gentleman by the name of Watis Venema, and he says, well, wait a second. If inetd is monitoring all these requests, and then it's going to start up the service, we have an opportunity to add in security controls. What if I create a piece of software that wraps itself around the services, and now, instead of inetd calling the service, inetd calls the wrapper, and the wrapper can perform security checks, validation, and detailed logging to provide an extra level of protection. So because this piece of security code wrapped itself around the services to provide an additional level of protection, it was called TCP wrappers. TCP wrappers provided a nice level of additional security to augment the functionality of inetd. So inetd was the functional piece, TCP wrappers was the security piece, and together they made a nice solution. What was the issue? TCP wrappers was third-party software. So you had to go in, download, compile, configure, and get it running. That was a lot of energy and a lot of effort for that to occur. So what they did in Linux is the latest version is they took inetd, they took TCP wrappers, they've combined it together, and they've created xinetd. So xinetd is inetd with TCP wrapper support automatically built in. So now you don't have to worry about compiling, configuring, or getting it set up to run on your system. So xinetd is just like inetd, the metademon, but now it has access control, denial of service, detailed logging, and additional security to be able to control and manage who can or who cannot stop and start other services on the system. We want to do the same automation and auditing on Windows that we did on Unix. I want to be able to go in and create a baseline of what services, processes, and files are on my system. I want to rerun that every night. I want to compare against the baseline, and I want to look for any deviation, changes, or alterations on the system. The way we would schedule jobs to run, like auditing or other security checks, is with cron. Cron is the scheduling service, and the list of jobs that cron's going to run is stored in the cron tab on the particular system. Now, if we go in and look at how a Unix system boots, actually the first two slides is true for any operating system. So whether we're talking about Unix, Windows, or any other variety, the initial steps are the same. When you walk up to a computer and you turn on the system, the first thing that takes place is BIOS kicks in. BIOS is the basic input-output system. It's firmware. And that firmware is going to go and look at the boot device and start up the bootloader. Now, just a quick side conversation. The name of the game with security is whoever can load first ultimately wins. So if I can load my security software before the malware loads, I'll be able to detect the malware and stop it. If the malware can load before the security software loads, then they win because they can lie and give false information. So originally, security software ran at the user level. So what did the malware do? The malware went in and loaded at the OS level. So what did we do? We went in and we started loading at the kernel level. And then what did the malware do? It started loading in at the boot level or MBR. We started going in and they start trying to load at the firmware level. So the earlier the malware can get loaded, the more damage on the system. The problem with BIOS, BIOS is pure functionality. It does no validation, integrity checks, or others. So therefore, newer computers, instead of BIOS, use the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface, the UEFI. UEFI is a replacement for BIOS that acts just like the BIOS does, but it performs integrity checking and verification and validation of the bootloader and the master boot record. So now if malware tries to run early in the process, it will be able to be caught with the UEFI, the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface, to be able to catch and flag that in the system. Now, UEFI is fairly new. It's within the last year that you're seeing it roll out in more and more systems. So in a control system environment, it's probably going to be a while before you really see that making it out into the system. But if you're buying standardized servers that are going to be loading HMIs or others within your supervisory network, if you make UEFI a requirement, you're adding an additional level of protection within your organization. So it's something, like I said, it's going to take a while to really be commonplace in control system environments, but I felt that if I didn't at least mention it to you, I'd be doing you a disservice. And if you're buying generic servers to support Historian or other functions, getting a little extra to get the UEFI is going to provide you just that a little additional level of protection. So if you're creating specs for new servers, I definitely recommend that you look at what we call Secure BIOS or UEFI, Unified Extensible Firmware Interface, to add in that extra level of protection and security. Then once your BIOS or your UEFI starts up, it's going to go to the boot device. It's going to look for the bootloader. The bootloader is then going to go to the MBR, the master boot record, which is a special portion on the hard drive. And on that master boot record, it's going to look for the kernel. If there's multiple kernels, a dual boot box, you're going to get a menu of options. If it's a single kernel then that single kernel is going to run and interface with the hardware to make it usable by the rest of the system. At this point is where Unix Linux is different. Prior to this, Windows was the exact same way. You always have BIOS, the boot device, the bootloader, to MBR, to kernel. That's standard operating systems. At this point is where Unix is different. Once the kernel is loaded in Unix, the kernel then starts the initialization process, which is nicknamed init. Init has five run conditions or directories that it's going to use to start up the system. So once init is running, init is going to go to the RC1 directory, and in that directory is going to be a series of scripts that it's going to start up running on the box. So it's going to go to the RC1 directory, and it's going to start all the scripts. Then it's going to go to the RC2 directory and start all the scripts. RC3, start all the scripts. And once it gets to run condition 5 and completes the execution of those scripts, the system is fully up and running and ready to be used by the operator or individual on that system. As I mentioned, when we start up the system, there are 5 run conditions. However, during the totality of running a Unix system, there's actually 7 run conditions. Wait, Eric, you told me there's 5, then there's 7. No. There's 5 for starting up the system, and there's 7 for the entire system. Well, why do we need additional? What is a run condition? A run condition is any time we're changing the running condition of the system. Well, of course, if my computer is off and I turn it on, that's changing the running condition. What are 2 other ways where we're changing the running condition? If it's on and we turn it off, that's called run condition 0. So if I go in and I'm running a system and I turn it off or halt it, that's run condition 0. And the second option is if I'm running the system and I restart it, that's run condition 6. So run condition 0 is shutting down, run conditions 1 through 5 is starting up, and run condition 6 is rebooting the system. Now, why do we have 5 run conditions for starting up, but only 1 run condition for shutting down? Easy. When I'm starting up the system, there's a lot of dependencies. I have to go in, and I have to do this before this, before this, before this. So therefore, I need more granularity, and I need 5 levels for doing that. However, when I'm shutting down or restarting a system, there's not a whole lot of dependencies. If you're shutting down your system, what do you do to all the services? Turn them off. There's not a whole lot of complexity or granularity that's needed. That's why when we're shutting down or restarted, there's a single level, turn everything off. But when we're starting up, we need a little more granularity because of the dependencies that are in play there. Now, here's the good news, bad news. All different varieties of Linux, heck, most of the different varieties of Unix, all work with run conditions. They're all going to have run conditions. They're all going to have 5 potential run conditions. Now, not every version uses all 5 during startup. Some use 1, 3, and 5. Some use 1, 4, and 5. Some use 1, 2, and 5. But there's 5 options. And all of them are going to have scripts in that respective directory. That's the good news. What's the bad news? The location of all of those are different for different varieties. So great. If the location of the run conditions, the default run conditions, and the scripts are all unique and different and implementation details, how in the world am I going to effectively be able to manage all these different varieties that are going to be present within my control system network? Easy. Almost all versions of Unix has an etc init tab file. Etc init tab is the treasure map. It shows you where everything is. So the first section in etc init tab shows you which of the 5 run conditions are going to be used when you start up the system. Is it 1, 3, and 5? Is it 1, 3, 4, and 5? Is it 1, 2, and 5? Then the second section of a knit tab is going to show you where the startup scripts are. And the third section is going to show you where the RCX directories are for the run conditions. So literally, you can walk in to a environment. You can sit in front of any Unix box. You can go to Etsy, a knit tab, and the third section will tell you where the directory is. The first section will tell you which run conditions are used, and the second section will go in and tell you where the scripts are located within that environment. So now all of a sudden, you can easily be able to identify and assess the security within that given environment for various versions of Unix and Linux. Now let's dig a little deeper. These run conditions are directories. So there's going to be an RC1, an RC2, an RC3, 4, and 5 directory. Now in each directory is going to be a series of scripts. How do we know what to do with each script? It's easy. If the first letter is an S, we start the script. If the first letter is a K, we kill the script. And if it's any other letter, we ignore it. So now, if we go in and we have anything that begins with an S, it gets started. We have anything that begins with a K, we kill it, and any other letter is ignored. Which means, if I want to stop a service from running at boot up, I would just change the name to something that doesn't begin with an S. So if I change the name of that script so it no longer starts with an S, it will be ignored and it will no longer start up. So if I want to disable services from running, I literally just have to change the name to something that doesn't have an S or a K. Now, I often get students that say, well, can I just delete it? If I don't want it to run at boot up, can I delete it? Yeah, that will work. What's the issue in control system environments? Reliability and availability are critical. And if you start going in and you start deleting files and you break something, how are you going to recover? It's not a smart thing to do in a critical environment like a control system. Therefore, the two rules of security and control systems, one is self-documenting changes. Anybody should be able to go into a system and quickly determine who made what change, when, where, and why. And the second rule is self-recoverable. You need to be able to recover very quick and very fast. So therefore, what we recommend to our clients in this space is if you want to disable a service, let's say you want to disable IP tables, we would rename it with the date and the initials of the person who disabled it, followed by the original name of the script. So what's today's date? Does anyone know the 6th? Okay. So if I want to go in and I want to disable IP tables, I would rename it to 120613EC-SO8 IP tables. So now you know on December 6th, Eric Cole disabled the SO8 IP table script. So it's self-documenting, it's self-recoverable, and you can get back up and running very quick if you need to. Those are the types of changes you want to make in this environment. Clear, self-documenting, easy to recover if possible. Great. What if I go in and there are 20 scripts that begin with an S? How do I know the order in which I start them? Well, after the letter S or K, there's going to be a priority number. The lower the number, the higher the priority. So in this case, I'm going to start 8, then 12, then 16, then 20. So literally, we're going to go in and we would label these priorities 4, 8, 12, 16, or 5, 10, 15, 20. Well, Eric, why aren't you naming them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7? Because once again, in Unix, we want to plan for growth. If I label my scripts priority levels 1 through 15, what if I wanted to add a new priority between 2 and 3? What would I have to do? I would have to rename 15 to 16, 14 to 15. That's very error prone and time consuming. So now by going in and using a multiplier like 4, 8, 12 or 5, 10, 15, 20, now there's room for growth. So if I need to go in and add in an additional level, I can go in and add in additional numbers between those without having to do any renaming. So we're sort of creating gaps to plan for growth to make it easier to scale for new processes and services on our system. iNetD and XiNetD are the super demons that monitor and watch activity to be able to start and stop other services. iNetD is purely functional. XiNetD is iNetD plus TCP wrappers combined together. So iNetD is purely functional. XiNetD is functional with security built into the system. So now that we understand how the processes get started and how they're running and ways that we would start to turn off and lock down and secure those services, the next section we're going to look at is logging and log management within our arena. One of the themes and the reason why in control systems we have an entire module on logging is we know our motto from day one. Prevention is ideal, but detection is a must.